Final case of the morning is number 013700, the United States against Polson. Ms. Laker.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm here on behalf of the defendant appellant, Andrew Polson, asking the court to vacate the sentence imposed by the district court and remand for resentencing with directions. Andrew Polson entered a guilty plea to transporting child pornography in interstate commerce. At sentencing, the district court, Judge Shabazz, applied a five-level increase to Polson's sentencing level because the court found that there was reliable evidence that Polson had engaged in a pattern of conduct involving the sexual abuse or exploitation of a minor pursuant to sentencing guidelines. It is this finding, which nearly doubled Polson's sentencing range, that Polson appealed. As the government agreed in its brief, Polson has a due process right to be sentenced on the basis of reliable information. The sentencing guidelines incorporate this right, stating that information considered at sentencing must have sufficient indicia of reliability to support its probable accuracy. And this court has recognized that the reliability standard must be rigorously applied. Here, the court found that there was sufficiently reliable evidence of three incidents and that those three incidents constituted the necessary pattern of conduct. The first allegation occurred in 1987 when 14-year-old Polson inappropriately touched a 4-year-old he was babysitting. At sentencing, Polson did not contest this incident, which resulted in a juvenile adjudication and a year of supervision. The evidence presented of the second and third incidents, however, was extremely unreliable and should not have formed the basis of the pattern of conduct finding. The evidence of incident number two amounted to the following. The government introduced a transcript of a taped interview of the mother of the 4-year-old, the same 4-year-old who was involved in the first incident, during which the mother stated, "I asked her if this has happened before because he had babysat before, and she said yes." That's the total of the government's evidence of incident number two. And considered in the light of a rigorously applied reliability standard, there is simply nothing reliable about a 4-year-old's one-word response to a possibly ambiguous question, which is reported to the mother, who tells it to a police officer, who has it transcribed into a written statement, which is presented to the court. The evidence of incident number three was at least as unreliable. At sentencing, a police officer testified that 4 years ago, a 9-year-old told him that 6 years previously, when she was three, Polson had touched her pelvic area while he was babysitting. Again, considered in the light of a rigorously applied reliability standard, there is simply nothing reliable about an incident, about the hearsay statement of a 9-year-old about an incident that occurred when she was three.
Except when he was questioned, he knew it, but he remembered the incident, didn't he?
He did remember the incident.
So there is some corroboration that it did in fact take place from his own mouth.
Well, there's only the hearsay statement from the girl to the officer. The officer did testify to his recollections of the interview, but it's still the hearsay statement of the girl. Also, the officer's comments about...
But he questioned Mr. Polson about this matter.
Yes, and his comments...
Mr. Polson did acknowledge that the incident had taken place.
He acknowledged that he had babysat the girl, and he offered his explanation for what had happened, which was that he had applied some cream because of a diaper rash.
Now, did he offer that explanation before or after the police officer told him the alleged victim's name, identified the incident?
I believe the officer told Polson why he was there. I don't believe he had told Polson the girl's name. But Polson recalled the incident and explained to the officer his recollection of what had happened.
Polson didn't offer any contrary evidence, did he?
I believe he did, Your Honor.
He didn't really cross-examine the police officer.
Polson's counsel at trial cross-examined both officers in a very limited way, only to the extent of establishing that neither of them had direct evidence of the allegations. And the government...
I mean, it's different to stand up and say, don't believe any of this evidence, which I think is what Polson essentially did here, than offering evidence to the contrary.
Well, the trial court did have before it evidence to the contrary. not only the cross-examination that questioned the reliability of the evidence, but also Polson's counsel called into question the accuracy of the evidence by pointing to Polson's explanations for what had happened. And the police reports that the district court had contained Polson's denials of both incidents and his explanations for what had happened at both incidents. So I think the court did have contrary evidence before it. And my second point on that issue is that the government contends that Polson did not meet his burden of production of presenting some evidence. But I think that that ignores the first step in the analysis, which is that it's the government's initial obligation to present reliable evidence. As this court stated in United States versus Koontz, the burden shifts to the defendant to present some evidence challenging the allegations only if the government has initially presented evidence with sufficient indicia of reliability. And it is our position that the government did not do so here. The government, in its brief, contends that there is a great deal of other evidence that corroborates its meager hearsay evidence of these disputed incidents. But the evidence the government cites does not corroborate that these incidents occurred. For example, the government cites some of the contents of Polson's website. It cites his diagnosis of a pedophile, but general information about Mr. Polson's involvement with child pornography can't corroborate that these specific events occurred. Courts have affirmed sentences based on hearsay evidence where there is supplemental evidence that directly concerns the disputed allegation, such as other witnesses or reports concerning the disputed fact or incident. The court's treatment of sentencing based on drug quantities is instructive in this context. In those cases, courts have consistently rejected the government's contention that evidence of a defendant's extensive involvement with drugs, drug use, drug dealing, corroborates hearsay estimates of drug quantities. For example, in United States versus Baylor, this court stated, Baylor's cocaine dealings extended beyond the 31.8 grams for which he was convicted. Yet the fact that Baylor made other cocaine sales does not corroborate the specific estimates of drug quantity provided by the informant. The same thing could be said of Polson here. The fact that he had extensive child pornography involvement and one incident of child sexual abuse does not corroborate the specific allegations of other incidents. If there are no further questions, I ask that this court vacate the sentence and remand with instructions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wade. We'll hear now from Mr. Graber.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dan Graber. I represent the United States, and I am the assistant U.S. attorney who prosecuted Mr. Polson. In this case, Your Honors, the district court did not abuse its discretion in finding that the government's hearsay evidence was reliable and in finding a five-level enhancement for 2G2.2. The defense is arguing that the government's evidence was hearsay evidence, that it was unreliable, that it was uncorroborated, and in fact, I think counsel said, when considered in the light of the rigorously applied reliability standard, it's not enough. That is the fatal flaw in their argument, what they just said there, because they're misconstruing the issue and they're misconstruing the standard of review. When the issue in this case is whether Judge Shabazz, he made a finding that that hearsay evidence was reliable. When a district court at a sentencing makes that finding that a hearsay evidence is reliable, that's it. The ground's been plowed. They're asking you to replow that ground, to do, in effect, de novo review, take your own look at the evidence, and find that he didn't do a rigorous application of the reliability standard. That was his job to do. He did it. He made findings on the record. It's over with. The standard of review at this point for that issue now is abuse of discretion. What this court says in the Seventh Circuit is when a district court makes a finding of reliability on hearsay evidence for sentencing, we will review for abuse of discretion. We will give great deference to the finding of the district court, and we will only find abuse of discretion when the defendant proves two things to us. One, that the information in front of the district court was inaccurate, and two, that the district court relied on that inaccurate information.
Would there be a way we could look at it and say there's, under no circumstances could this be reliable, in that you've got to take, let's just take the incident where the little girl said yes, it happened more than once, or the one where the 9-year-old's reflecting back when she was 3. If we were to look at that and say, and not saying we would, but as far as abuse of discretion, it would be something more than just reliability. You'd have to say that is just inherently unacceptable because it can't be reliable.
Correct.
Effectively unreliable, I guess.
And what this court has done, there's three big cases in this circuit that deal with this issue. Barnes, Musa, and Francis. And what you've done before in Barnes, you've said, when you're doing this, you look to see whether the defendant had noticed that the government was going to use hearsay evidence and whether he had an opportunity or she had an opportunity to rebut it. If they did, and they didn't get the job done in front of the district court, you're not going to find abuse of discretion. That happened in this case. He was given notice that we were going to use hearsay evidence, and he had an opportunity to rebut, and he didn't get the job done. In Musa, you've held that, as you just said, Judge, a bald assertion, a bald denial, it didn't happen, isn't good enough to meet your burden that it's abuse of discretion. That's not good enough getting on the stand at sentencing and saying, that didn't happen. You got to have more. And in Francis, what this court said was, you've got to come forward. You've got subpoena power at sentencing, defendant. You can take the stand. You can call witnesses. You've got to put some contrary evidence in there to rebut the government's evidence. And if you don't do that, there's no way that you can prove that the government's evidence was inaccurate. And that's exactly what happened in this case. There's no evidence in the record to show that he did not commit those three incidences. He provided nothing. All he does in this case, and all he does in the brief, is take issue with our evidence and take potshots at it and talk to the quality of the evidence. But as you, Judge, just said before, it's one thing to take potshots at the quality of the evidence. It's another thing to say, it didn't happen, and here's my evidence on why it didn't happen. And that was never presented by him to Judge Chavez. And this court in Musa, Barnes, and Francis says that's what you need, defendant, if you're going to show abuse of discretion. And when you look at it that way, when you get away from this red herring of doing a de novo review and you get into the proper standard of review and you look at the issue properly, you see that he's failed utterly in his burden to prove that there was inaccurate information in front of the court and that the court relied on it, and therefore there's abuse of discretion. Now, they bring up some points, and I'm sure they're going to bring it up in rebuttal. When he was questioned on the 1987 incident, they went, after they talked to the mother, they went to the high school, and the police officer asked him at the high school, what's your side of the story? And he says, it never happened. You know, kids, when they're babysitting, they make it up. So there's a denial. Judge Chavez found that denial to be a lie, that it wasn't accurate, because 2 months later he enters into a plea to a juvenile adjudication of actually sexually assaulting that child. So that was a false denial. There's nothing in the record to say that denial was true. In fact, his own conduct subsequently undercuts that denial. The 1991 incident, where you've got the 9-year-old saying, 6 years ago when I was 3, Andy babysat me, and he touched me inappropriately, that too is corroborated. You've got...
Was he 14 in that time too?
Oh, he was... In 87, he was 14.
What do you mean on the second one?
On the second one in 91, he was 18 when he was babysitting the 3-year-old. And Judge Chavez found that one to be similar, and he found that one to be similar because you've got the same MO. Here's Andy Poulsen babysitting again. You've got the same victim profile. A small child, 3 to 4 years old, saying that she's been vaginally penetrated again. And you've got a similar in time, 87 and 91. And you've got the prior adjudication in 87 that he's done it before to show that that's what happened. And his statement, which we've touched on briefly, he did make a statement. The cops came to him again that second time. They said, Andy, we need to talk to you about a sexual assault. They didn't give the name of the victim. Boom, out of his mouth, he says,
You know what? I remember 6 years ago that this incident occurred where I put some Neosporin on victim X. He names the victim. That happens to be the one that gives the complaint. And then it burned her, so I washed it off. And the police said, well, if that's the case, did you tell her parents at the time that that happened? No, I didn't. It wasn't that big a deal. It slipped my mind. Well, if it wasn't that big a deal and it slipped your mind, how are you remembering right now? I don't want to answer any more questions. I want a lawyer. Shuts down the questioning at that point. The detective that I put on the stand to bring that evidence out was the same detective who actually interviewed him then, and he testified when he questioned him on the front porch that day, he watched his physical composure. He was swallowing, his voice was shaking, his hands were shaking, he was on the verge of tears. The detective gave the opinion, this kid's lying to me, he's not telling me the truth, he's making up this story, and the story itself is illogical.
Well, at this time of the interview, he's how old?
18 years old.
Well, he's 18 when he did it.
He would have been 18 in 91, and then 6 years later, in 97, when he's being questioned, you've got 6 years, 24. And so that's the incidences that were before Judge Shabazz, and he made the finding the hearsay evidence is reliable, these incidences did occur, and he made the finding, look, Mr. Polson, you didn't give me anything to the contrary. You didn't give me anything to the contrary to prove otherwise, and I'm finding, therefore, that these are reliable hearsay incidences and that they did occur and that they support the five-level increase. And when you look at it under the proper standard of review, he utterly fails in his burden, and it shows that his appeal has no merit, and we'd ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graber. You have 2.5 minutes, Ms. Leiker.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, on the standard of review issue, Mr. Graber seems to be saying that this court has no role when reviewing for clear error. He said the inquiry regarding the reliability of the evidence is over. We concede that the standard of review here is a low one, but there still is a role for this court. This court still needs to make its own inquiry, not de novo review, but an inquiry whether the court below committed clear error in its finding of reliability. And with this extremely unreliable, uncorroborated evidence, Polson has met this burden. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. Ms. Leiker, a special thanks to you since you took this case by appointment of the court, and the court deeply appreciates your efforts on behalf of your client. The case will be taken under advisement.